We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This podcast episode is brought to you by Coors Light. These days, everything is go, go, go. It's nonstop hustle all the time. Work, friends, family expect you to be on 24/7. Well, sometimes you just need to reach for a Coors Light because it's made to chill. Coors Light is cold lagered, cold filtered, and cold packaged. It's as crisp and refreshing as the Colorado Rockies. It is literally made to chill. Coors Light is the one I choose when I need to unwind. So when you want to hit reset, reach for the beer that's made to chill. Get Coors Light in the new look delivered straight to your door with Drizzly or Instacart. Celebrate responsibly. Coors Brewing Company, Golden, Colorado.
Support for this podcast comes from U.S. Bank. When it's time for a new credit card, the best ones do way more than just buy stuff. And that's why U.S. Bank offers credit cards that make every day more rewarding. Earn cash back, score points when you shop, dine out, travel, or binge watch, or get a low intro APR. U.S. Bank credit cards were designed to fit your lifestyle. So make every day more rewarding and check out usbank.com/creditcard. U.S. Bank credit cards are issued by U.S. Bank National Association N.D. Some restrictions may apply. Member FDIC.
Welcome in to the RotoWire NFL podcast. I'm your host, John McKechnie, joined as always by Mario Puig. Today is March 26th. It's been about 8 days since our last recording here, Mario. How have you been holding up?
Oh, fine. Had enough time, I suppose, to get really deep into the rookie class and posted a top 100 rookie dynasty rankings thing, so that should settle that until the draft, which who knows how that's going to be done, but it looks like they're going to do it. So that's all set. Free agency is kind of reaching sort of a, you know, a slowing point. So we're kind of getting an idea of how things are going to look for the next season. And yeah, it's just a few details to settle before then, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, with no pro days, like you said, that your top 100 rookie rankings, there probably won't be a ton of movement between now and then just based on that fact.
Yeah.
So also this week, you released a 2-round mock draft. So you've clearly been diving deep. I'm working my way towards getting on that level. I've been watching some defenders this week, been watching mostly linebackers, and then I've shifted to edge players earlier this afternoon. So working my way towards getting caught up on that front, been doing some cleanup on random college football things. But you did a 2-round mock, so that's going to be the focus of what we talk about today. We're also going to talk about some of those free agent odds and ends that hadn't been announced when we recorded last week. So let's start things off. Round one, pick one. We got Joe Burrow going to Cincinnati. That seems to be the case right now. I was actually asked about this, and you mentioned it in your article as well. I was asked about it on the radio down in Orlando the other day. You know, the possibility of would Miami really use that first round ammunition that they have? They have three picks. Would they use that to move up to get Joe Burrow? And I personally think that that would be an insane misstep. I think the Dolphins have actually done pretty well for themselves this offseason and getting things lined up for the rebuild. You know, I think that there's maybe a light at the end of the tunnel here in 2 or 3 years for this Dolphins team. But I think 3 first-round picks for anyone less than a Trevor Lawrence next year would be a misuse of that type of pick. I think you can just use those picks to fill a hole. If you want to jump up to number 3 and package 2 of your first-round picks, something like that, you know, you can talk me into that a little bit more. But Joe Burrow doesn't – he's not the face that sails 1,000 ships to me. What do you think?
Yeah, I wouldn't want to pay too much for him. It's one of those things, though. I can't tell how serious those reports were. And you can't believe much of what you hear as far as kind of off-the-record or sourced pre-draft reports. Even someone like Jake Glazer might miss a thing here, or not miss a thing here or there, but there's just so much noise, and no one can actually know for sure just who's got what interest in propelling which lie or which truth. So unless the Dolphins are very high on Joe Burrow, they don't really need to move up, because there's probably like a good amount of reason to believe that they are actually totally content with one or both of Tua Tagovailoa or Justin Herbert at the 5th pick. We don't know if they feel strongly about these 3 players in any particular order. And like you said, with 3 first round picks and 2 second round picks, it's at once a lot of ammo, but it's not ammo I would want to spend for an occasion like Joe Burrow. And as much as he was probably responsible for the single best quarterback season in college football history, I think that there was a lot of things going in his favor that kind of enabled an outcome that other quarterbacks probably could have seen too. For instance, I basically just think that Joe Burrow is Jared Goff, who can run more, which could be very good. That could be a top 10 NFL quarterback. But I think I agree with you that it needs to be a Trevor Lawrence type, or at least a Kyler Murray type. Like, I think Murray's a better prospect than Burrow was. Oh, yeah. So it would at least need to be like a Kyler Murray kind of prospect, and the next quarterback class would need to look weak for me to do that. And there's not necessarily much after Lawrence next year, but that he is there would make it worth, you know, saving assets for something else. And they can get some good players with these picks that make maybe a supporting cast strong enough that they don't even need a great quarterback. But yeah, I think they'll take one of Herbert or Tua. I have no idea which. I think there's valid cases to make for either, and I don't really want to take a side in it. But yeah, I think Herbert is better for fantasy projection, just because with his huge frame, the 4.68 40 and good athletic testing all around, also no hip injury concerns, He could at least run a good amount in the NFL. Like, it's hard for me, even as somebody who isn't that high on Herbert, it's hard for me to look at his prospect profile and have a reason to say you would not be able to do the same things with him as you do with Josh Allen. Like, you can, maybe he's not a great passer, but maybe his running ability and maybe the big frame that he has, maybe the hits that he can afford to take in the ground game, maybe they can be used to open up throwing windows to kind of minimize his limitations as a passer. So with Tua, it's like he puts up, you know, he's the more convincing pure passer.
Oh, yeah.
And I think most people like him more as a prospect. I just don't feel like I'm in a good position to know what the significance of the hip is. And for whatever it's worth, I feel like there is not like a case you want to specifically make against him as a prospect, but I would be a little leery of the at a glance value of his production when he had the receivers that he did at Alabama. And for whatever limitations Herbert might have, his receivers at Oregon were kind of crap. Like, it was Dylan Mitchell was the best one, followed by, I don't know, Johnny Jefferson or whatever had an okay season this year, I guess, but mostly garbage. So yeah, it's fair, I think, to be agnostic, or at least I'm agnostic on these two and the order that they're in. I'm not really that high on them, but it looks like they're going to go high. And if they're going to go as high as the NFL media chatter indicates, then they're both going to go they'll go in some order at 5 or 6 at the latest, assuming there's no kind of trade up activity.
Right. So when it comes to Herbert and Tua, you know, I think that it's totally within reason to expect Herbert to go first just because he doesn't have that glaring red flag of that injury concern, and it goes beyond the hip with Tua as well. I mean, we had each of the last 2 years he had to have tightrope procedures after he suffering high ankle sprains there, so he definitely hasn't proven to be as durable as Herbert. Herbert had a broken collarbone at one point way long time ago in his college career, but like you said, frame wise, nothing really to worry about as far as the injury concerns go with Herbert. I do think that Tua is leaps and bounds better than Herbert as just a pure prospect as a quarterback in general. But again, when you're hitching the amount of draft capital that you would need, having the health assurance cleared off is huge. So I definitely get it when it comes to Herbert. I just wish after 4 years of starting at Oregon and like you said, the kind of crappy receivers, especially for a program as strong as Oregon's was, especially his last couple of years once Cristobal took over. I just wish that there was a little bit more of Herbert really, really taking over production-wise. But again, there are things to like about him enough to see him go either 5 or 6 here. And, you know, I'm kind of like you, agnostic onto who's going to take him between Miami or the Chargers. But you do figure at the end of the day, by the time that the Chargers turn in their pick at number 6, 3 quarterbacks will be off the board. Let's move on now. I think one of the prevailing narratives over the course of draft season and, you know, dating back to probably the fall, honestly, or even last season, looking at this year's crop of receivers, it's been Jeudy or Lamb. But with the way that Henry Ruggs performed at the combine, even though he didn't get the full workout, but the insane 40 time, in addition to people going back and looking at the tape a little bit closer and realizing that he's not only speed, that there is a little bit more of a complete element to his game, whereas Jeudy and Lamb didn't really light up the combine. They just sort of checked the boxes relative to their expectations. You make a case here that Ruggs has a very plausible shot of being the first receiver off the board, and that could be, well, in this particular scenario, you have Miami making a trade with Cleveland here to go up and get Ruggs and add him to their receiving core.
Yeah, and that was just kind of an experimental thought scenario kind of thing. It's not that I feel strongly, or I don't even suspect any particular thing with these three guys and the order they'll go. To me, it looks like they're going to go probably within a 4 or 5 pick range. Maybe they all go back to back to back, and I don't think it'll be predictable the reason why they go in the order that they do, because there's not any easy way to look at the likely candidates to draft them and look at them like, oh, well, this team clearly could use CeeDee Lamb more than Jerry Jeudy, therefore that's an obvious match. It's more like you can imagine all the teams who are plausible buyers kind of just having, you know, arbitrary rankings or kind of liking all the above. It's hard to tell what will be the reason for whatever order they eventually go in. But yeah, with Miami having 3 first-round picks, 2 second-round picks, and then they also have a 3rd and a 4th, I projected them to trade one of their 3rds while swapping like their 5th and 4th with the Browns. And part of the reason that I made that Henry Ruggs trade projection is I feel like the Browns will want to trade down if they can't get at one of Jedrick Wills or Andrew Thomas or Tristan Wirfs. And in the projection for the mock that I made, I had all 3 of those gone in the first 9 picks. So I had Cleveland looking to trade back, and I was like, well, I guess if anybody would want to trade up, it would be Miami or somebody like that, and Ruggs would be one of the players they might trade up for. The Dolphins still have a lot of work to do on their offensive line, so if they were trading up from the 18th pick, you could say they'd be more likely to go for Jacksonville at 9 or Arizona at 8 to get one of those tackles. But I projected, I think all those teams in the top 9 could, or sorry, those 3 teams that I projected those 3 tackles to, I think they really kind of need tackles, especially the rare kind of prospects that those 3 guys are. So yeah, it's not that I think Ruggs will go first. It just seems totally plausible to me because I feel like those top 3 guys have about even odds. And in any case, Ruggs would be a good pick for Miami, I think, because Devontae Parker and Preston Williams are really impressive, but they're not exactly fast, and they probably can't play that much inside. So having Ruggs as a slot guy who can really make the safeties think twice before creeping up, that could kind of mitigate their pass blocking issues a little bit. I have them taking a tackle a little later in the round, I believe. Yeah, Lucas Niang at the end of the first round. But if Miami can't make its offensive line better going into this year, then it would be nice to have someone as fast as Ruggs to make teams think twice about, you know, doing more aggressive blitz setups. But yeah, with Ruggs there, that would give some speed to the Miami offense that really has none. Parker's probably their fastest guy, followed by like Gesicki.
Yeah.
So that's a slow offense, and you don't want a defense playing like a red zone style defense against a quarterback as inaccurate and just turnover prone as Fitzpatrick, especially with the pass rush that he's probably going to have to deal with. But yeah, I have Judy go to the Jets after that, and I don't feel strongly about that one either. It's just one of those things. Like, Adam Gase is a trips like slot receiver kind of enthusiast. Like, that's the part of the field that he really likes to attack in the passing game. And Judy's such an obviously innately talented route runner, mm-hmm. In a way that's really uncommon. Like, his athletic traits are pretty common. His production, it's really good, not truly rare. But when you watch the tape, his route running ability, it would stand out to anybody. Like, someone who's watched football for, you know, just 2 minutes looking at examples of various NFL wide receivers, they would look at Judy and notice like something's a little different about this guy. So I can imagine coaches falling in love with him on a technical basis, production basis, whatever. I can imagine Gase liking CD Lamb a lot too. I have really no idea, but I feel like they're going to go receiver there. They could take Mekhi Becton, the offensive tackle, but I think they consider their offensive line fixed after spending the same amount of money on George Fant as the Chargers did Bulaga. That will not age well. But, you know, dumb teams that, you know, they're going to do dumb stuff. And not that I think they should take Becton over Judy or Lamb. I think they should take Judy or Lamb. But it's just disheartening to me as a Sam Darnold believer that it's like my awesome and totally good prediction that he will be really good might be undone by a George Fant signing instead of Bulaga. But anyway, yeah, I have CeeDee Lamb going next to the Raiders. So I think those three could go back to back to back.
Okay. And when it comes to Judy and in that proverbial fit with the Jets, you mentioned, you know, that route running potentially being the tiebreaker between him and Lamb, given what Gase likes to do with his receivers there. Would that signing of Breshad Perriman yesterday kind of change your mind about Judy maybe landing in New York? And also, just like, what are your thoughts on Judy in terms of like where he's going to play? Is he going to be an inside outside type of receiver? Is he going to be strictly outside? What do you think his best usage would look like in the NFL?
I think Judy could play anywhere. I mean, he's not exactly a classic deep threat, and you might want to have a classic deep threat as your kind of outermost receiver, but he's just such a good route runner. You can imagine him getting open deep the same way Stephon Diggs gets open deep. It's like Stephon Diggs was timed at something like 4.53 at the combine. It doesn't look, he's not an obvious burner. It's not obvious why he should get open deep as much as he does sometimes, but Judy can probably do stuff like that. It's just like, you can imagine him more so working underneath and in the intermediate, because it's just easier to complete those passes. And he's the kind of guy with the kind of frequency with which he can get open. You can imagine him being kind of a workhorse underneath. And, you know, if he's the third best receiver in an offense, maybe then he gets more of like a specialist role in some part of the field. I'm not sure. But the thing is, with Perriman, you would expect him to be that downfield specialist. And Jamison Crowder is going to be in the slot, and I think he's going to get a lot of work there. I think he's a pretty much prototypical player for what Gase likes to do. And I think Judy's kind of similar that way, just kind of like that dart quick sort of game. And I feel like their three wide set of Jerry Judy, Jamison Crowder, Breshad Perriman would make a lot of sense. I don't know what they think of Quincy Enunwa, excuse me, at this point. They gave him a pretty sizable contract, but he's been hurt so much. I don't know if they already regret that or what it is. It wouldn't be the most shocking thing, though, if the Jets do something stupid, or at least I think this would be stupid. It would be, I think, foolish of them to look at that Perriman signing and then say, like, all right, we're out of the receiver market in the first round. Let's take CJ Henderson or somebody like that, so Greg Williams's defense can look better. That would be a bad idea, but I could imagine that too.
Yeah, so Jets kind of a wild card here, but yeah, I definitely don't think that they're addressing their receiver concerns are fixed yet. So maybe the draft is deep enough to where they think about using it in round two. But I mean, if Jerry Judy's standing, staring them at in the face at pick 11, that should be something that they heavily consider. Let's get into the CD Lamb pick going to Vegas potentially here. So I think they're sort of like how Perriman doesn't fix the Jets receiving core. Obviously, Nelson Aguilar going to the Raiders doesn't really change a ton there. So they're obviously going to be in the market for a receiver that they need a true complement on the outside to pair up with Darren Waller, because Hunter Renfrow, you know, limited to just the slot work, and Tyrell Williams pretty good, but I think that they could really, really make this offense pretty interesting if they add at receiver there, and Lamb would certainly do that.
Yeah, with the Raiders, it looks like they should go receiver, to me at least, with this pick, because they have two first-rounders, and they don't have that many obvious needs. Like, they're not a good team at a glance, but they don't have obvious needs in the sense that they've already tied up a lot of positions where they maybe aren't good, but they have so many investments that they're waiting on in those spots that they can't really double up, and you know, their defense might be crap, their cornerbacks might be bad or something, but it's like when you have Trayvon Mullen there, I don't know if it makes a ton of sense to go for CJ Henderson at that spot. They could. Daryl Worley did, I guess, reasonably well as the other starter, and then in the slot they have LaMarcus Joyner, so it's like corner, I don't see why they would obviously go that way. And so in terms of where they aren't already invested substantially, I think receiver is pretty clearly the position where they have kind of an opening, and then it also fits with the best player available, which I absolutely consider CeeDee Lamb at that spot. So he's actually my favorite receiver in the draft. It's just that I can imagine him going third between him, Ruggs, and Judy. Ruggs because of the speed just being crazy, and Judy because of his just very obviously unique route running ability, the crazy fast start-stop that Jerry Judy and his feet are capable of. It shows elite potential at a glance, whereas with Lamb, you kind of get a lot of, like, there are some standout plays that he makes, don't get me wrong. He makes a lot of really crazy plays, actually. But he doesn't have a trait that you obviously spot for unique right away when you start watching him. And because he didn't test out of the world at the combine, he had good testing, like Judy. He had good but not great testing. I think that CeeDee Lamb has legitimate, like, top 10 receiver potential, and I think he can be a workhorse wide receiver one type, the kind of guy who can take you between the 20s and the guy who can score once you get in the red zone because of the ball skills that he showed at Oklahoma, and he has a better catch radius than the other two top receivers in this draft. But because he's just a low 4-5 guy, and because he doesn't have any obviously just like insanely fast feet like Judy, I think he could lose in the aesthetic, the eyeball test. And, you know, it's a fair tiebreaker. I mean, these are three really good prospects, and, you know, you got to break the tie somehow. But I like CeeDee Lamb and what he brings. I think he looks a lot like a faster, more innately talented Brandon Lloyd. And while that doesn't have any obviously unique traits with it, I think it's a proven template that works. And I think that CeeDee Lamb just can hurt a defense a lot of ways, even if there isn't one single way that he stands out from everyone else.
Yeah, I love CeeDee Lamb after the catch. He always finds a way to get open. He seems to, you know, for his size, he wins the contested catches pretty well too. So yeah, I think you gave an excellent breakdown.
He's dangerous everywhere,
right,
pretty much. Like, he's maybe not as good like at the line of scrimmage as Judy. Maybe he's not as dangerous on a short catch, but I just really like that Lamb can hurt teams on the sideline, down the field, in traffic, like you said. Like, he's got a really good catch radius that he presents, and a lot of coordination and innate skill to go with it, I think.
Yeah, so this receiver class, as advertised, really, really impressive, especially at the top there. But there's a lot of depth to it as well, as we'll get to a little bit later on here in the show. Let's move on to the Raiders' next pick. That's the next one that has fantasy relevance for us. The Raiders using that pick from the Khalil Mack trade and going ahead and potentially getting their quarterback of the future here, Jordan Love, out of Utah State.
Yeah, so this is a complicated situation, and maybe it's a misread on my part to think that the Raiders would take Love in the first round. But even with that Marcus Mariota contract and the kind of co-starter sort of situation that it implies. Like his incentives could go up to something like $20 million a year if he plays enough. And so it's pretty clearly like they've got a quick hook for Derek Carr this year, assuming Derek Carr is still there anyway. For all I know, they could trade him or something and then take Love, and Mariota could be their first starter. Who really knows? But Jordan Love is not that strong of a quarterback prospect, in my opinion. Like he's interesting. He's got some tools, definitely, and he's got enough size. He's very athletic for how big he is. But there was some pretty concerning passing details in his stats at Utah State. So I wouldn't really want to be the person buying him here. But if the Raiders have lost some substantial amount of faith in Derek Carr, and if they are not sold on Mariota, so it's one of those things like, when are you going to take a quarterback then, if not now? And I don't know. I maybe this isn't quite it. Maybe they would take Jalen Hurts ahead of Jordan Love. That would not surprise me one bit if Jalen Hurts went ahead of Jordan Love. But I have to defer somewhat to plugged in NFL media and someone like Daniel Jeremiah putting, I think anyway, he's been putting Jordan Love in the first round. I don't want to misquote his mock drafts, but I feel like I've seen a ton of projections of Jordan Love going in the first round from people who are closer to these teams than me. So as much as I wouldn't want to make that choice, it's one of those things like I have to believe these people know something that I don't, and that something is going to propel Jordan Love to those top 40 picks. And as long as you're a quarterback in that range, then you kind of tend to float toward the top. Like there tends to be a last second inflation, even if people don't anticipate it. So Jordan Love, if he's got a shot at the first round, then he's probably going in the first round. And the Raiders seem like as good of a candidate to take him as any, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, there's stuff that you can dream on when it comes to Jordan Love. And like if you watch like the actual broadcast of the combine, obviously Burrow and Tua weren't throwing, so the stage was kind of set for Herbert and Love to kind of make big waves, big names for themselves. And it was almost like gross hearing like people's reactions watching Jordan Love. They're like, oh my god, like there it is, like moaning and groaning watching like how hard he throws and stuff like that. So they love the arm, like they just really do. And it so that might be enough. Maybe Mayock falls into that camp as a guy that really just is all about the big arm. And what a contrast that would be to Derek Carr, who
it's true.
Yeah,
I mean he's got a lot more tools than Derek Carr. Derek Carr's fast. He's afraid to run, so it's Love doesn't have him there. But Love does definitely have that throwing toolsiness that's much higher than Derek Carr. And to be fair, as much as I think Love's production is really concerning, especially last year, he had a really bad team around him.
He did.
At Utah State. So
new system too.
Yeah, it might not be his fault, and maybe I on some level I have to defer to the people who really are quarterback experts. Like I am not a quarterback expert. I feel like there's some calls to make that are easy. Like someone like Lamar Jackson seems like an easy call to me, but then most calls don't seem easy to me, and Jordan Love is one of those guys.
Yeah, very very complicated profile because he really crushed it in 2018, but the interceptions this past year were very very disconcerting. So we'll see. I think at the bottom line, he will go in this draft as more of a project. Like I don't think that we're going to see him starting until 2021 personally. But
yeah, and the Raiders would work for that with having Carr and Mariota.
Exactly. So let's move on. Next receiver off the board, a guy who also dazzled at the combine, Denzel Mims, potentially landing in Philly at pick 21.
Yeah, so Mims is a player I have a lot of trouble figuring out, and I guess I could start by saying, like, I don't believe in a Baylor wide receiver curse or anything like that. Like, I know some people have looked at Baylor and been like, oh, I don't know, though. I mean, it's like Antoine Goodley and Tevin Reese and Corey Coleman and Terrence Williams and Corey Coleman. It was like, if that guy didn't get hurt, I am a truther. I have not lost faith about Corey Coleman.
Good.
But B, if he had not gotten hurt so much, we might have a very different narrative on him. Terrence Williams sucked. Yeah, that's true. But like Josh Gordon was at Baylor before he transferred to Utah and didn't play there. So I don't believe in like assist. I don't believe that wide receivers from Baylor are like fabricated by the system.
And
it's
a totally different system that Mims played in versus the Bryles. So
yeah, that's true. The one thing I will say about Mims is he's complicated to me, and he was more complicating to me before the combine, before he had his insane athletic testing, the 4.39 40, the 6.66 second three cone drill, the vertical, the broad jump. All that made me much higher on him because it just kind of removed some areas of doubt for me. But based on his production, there's not an obvious abundance of skill, and part of that might be because of just bad Baylor quarterbacks. Part of it might be other things that weren't in his control. I really don't know. But as much as he broke out in his second year at Baylor, he's a little bit overaged for his class. So it wasn't quite what people would normally get for a second year breakout. It was kind of like a second, two and a half, third year breakout kind of thing, which can still work, you know, especially when you're as toolsy as he is. When you have that kind of athleticism, you can afford to not be as skilled as the next guy. And the next guy, I think, would be Justin Jefferson, who most people project to the Eagles at this pick. But I kind of went with Whit Mims, not so much trying to like differentiate this mock, but because if they do take Justin Jefferson, I think that would be a little bit of a sort of vision mistake on their part, because going forward, that Philadelphia offense is going to be a two tight end offense. The base, like at least 3/4 of the time, I think, will be Dallas Goedert and Zach Ertz out there. And that has its pluses. You know, those guys are just really good, and they can make your offense more versatile from a single look. It's not as obvious whether they're going to run or a throw. But the thing is, if they do throw, and I guess even when they don't, the safeties are going to creep up on you if you don't have some speed to make them think otherwise about it. And Justin Jefferson's really good as a prospect, but his 4.43 40, his good vertical and broad jump, they still lose easily to Mims and his 4.39 and his better jumps, his better quickness. Just as players in college, it's like Justin Jefferson was more of a slot guy and Mims was more of a downfield specialist. And that's what the wide receiver in the Philadelphia offense needs to be if you're going to have two tight ends every play. Because right. if you don't have that downfield threat, then the safeties are just going to kind of like double your whatever, kind of both at the same time. They can double your tight ends and receivers with impunity. And you can't have an offense where like Zach Ertz is your best downfield threat. It's just asking for some trouble. So I think having somebody like Mims to make the safeties have to respect his speed makes sense from just a team fit perspective. But yeah, Justin Jefferson, I think we have reason to believe he is more skilled as a receiver because he's not as toolsy as Mims, and yet his production stood out more obviously at LSU. Mims got outplayed also by Jalen Hurd 2 years ago. So Mims broke out in his second year, kind of got pushed aside by Hurd in his third year. And there's a possibility that both Hurd and Mims are quite good. And so it's like, in that case, Mims, it's not his fault that he got pushed aside if the player that pushed him aside was simply very good. But if Hurd is not good, then that would kind of complicate the fortunes, I think, of Mims, because if Hurd is a bust, then it's hard to see why Mims kind of got marginalized by him. But again, for the Eagles, I feel like they need to look for speed with this pick. I think Jalen Reagor would make more sense for the Eagles than Justin Jefferson, but seems like it's going to, I don't know, more people, including people, and I feel like I can say this about Jeremiah this time. I am pretty sure he's been projecting Jefferson to the Eagles for basically
Yeah, that's been a common thread in pretty much every big mock, I feel like.
Yeah, so I don't feel strongly about it. I rank Justin Jefferson higher in my dynasty rankings just because he has youth on his side. He's very skilled already. It's just, I don't know if it would be the right fit for the Eagles.
Okay, fair. And, you know, I love that, you know, that you're bringing the team context and the lack of speed, especially on the outside, that the Eagles have as it stands right now. I mean, Jeffrey, not that kind of player. And like you said, you know, they are going to be using two tight ends out there, and I can't count on DeSean Jackson forever. So would like to get an infusion of speed there on the outside. Let's move on down here a little bit further. We have a conversion, Mario. We have you projecting Jalen Hurts in the first round now.
Yeah, so wild. I mean, back when I watched him at Alabama, I thought, you know, this is a great college quarterback, and that's it, because he had some pretty concerning accuracy deficiencies, and that stayed a little bit the case with Oklahoma, too. But in a league where Josh Allen goes 7th overall or whatever, and where Daniel Jones goes 5th, I can't really marginalize Jalen Hurts on the grounds of his accuracy limitations anymore. Like, it's still something that kind of concerns me, but it's either the NFL doesn't care as much anymore, or something has changed about the NFL that I can't quite figure out yet. It's just I have enough reason to believe that it is happening that I need to make some kind of adjustment in response. And as much as I wouldn't have projected Hurts to so much as like be a starting quarterback candidate a few years ago, it's like I said the same about Josh Allen and Daniel Jones. They both got drafted really high. They both have been useful in fantasy very, you know, importantly. And that could very much be the case with Jalen Hurts too, because at the very least, we know he can run at a standout level. And if teams are okay with these substandard college passers like Josh Allen and Daniel Jones, then I don't know why they would be especially harsh toward Jalen Hurts. And so part of the other thing that precipitated this projection of the Colts trading up three spots with the 49ers just to get ahead of I don't know who it would be, maybe the 49ers themselves, maybe the Lions. But I had the Colts trade up three spots, trading a fourth round pick to get to the 31st spot, taking Jalen Hurts, because they're not going to be in position, or at least if assuming nothing goes terribly wrong, they won't likely be in position to be in the Trevor Lawrence sweepstakes. I think you're going to have to put on a really convincing tank effort to do that. And I kind of think that Phillip Rivers will keep them at a sort of 7-9, 8-8 sort of baseline. And if they don't take a quarterback now, it's not obvious when they'll get another obvious chance to do it. So I think that going up three spots here, taking Jalen Hurts and letting him learn behind Rivers for a year might be their best option. And it's also kind of like if Jordan Love is going in the first, I don't know why Jalen Hurts would be ruled out either. It's like he put up basically the same numbers at Oklahoma as Baker Mayfield and Kyler Murray. Right. I don't think he's as good of a prospect as either one. I don't think it's especially close. But again, in a league where Daniel Jones is, you know, putting up fantasy points, it just seems reasonable to think that Hurts could do that too.
Yeah, Jalen Hurts has, I mean, he tested well at the combine. I mean, we're talking like sub 4.6 speed. And, you know, I think that Lincoln Riley definitely got the most out of him and probably, you know, helped improve Jalen Hurts' game overall, and probably more so than what he got at Alabama. Not to like trash Alabama's quarterback development or anything, but I think that you can say right now that Oklahoma is churning out, you know, pro quarterbacks left and right in a way that Alabama isn't necessarily. So, you know, it couldn't have been a better landing spot for Hurts when he transferred, and I think that he's come a long way since, you know, like you said, when he was a freshman back in 2016, and just basically having to out-athlete everyone at the quarterback position. It looks a lot different now, so who's to say that he's not a first-rounder? And then let's round it out for the first round. We got a running back finally going off the board. Who you got?
Yeah, I projected Jonathan Taylor at the 32nd pick with the Chiefs, and that's not something that I feel strongly about exactly. It's just I think that Taylor is pretty clearly the most talented pure runner since Adrian Peterson. That's not to say he's the best running back prospect since then, because I'd probably rank Ezekiel Elliott or somebody like that higher than him, mostly for passing, mostly with respect to the passing game. Not to rule out Taylor becoming good in that respect either, but it's just, you know, it's a question. It's not for sure like it was with Elliott coming out. And the thing that is for sure with Thomas, with Taylor, though, is he's insanely talented as a runner, and it's obvious. Like, I know a lot of people are trying to find reasons to overthink it. Maybe they're just bored. They need something to do, because if you look at Taylor and these other running backs and think anybody but him is even close, or sorry, if you think that any of the others are even close to him as a runner, it's just an error in logic. Like there's no precedent to believe that. So if Andy Reid can take someone like Spencer Ware and make him a productive pass catcher, which he did, if you go look at Spencer Ware's pass catching with Kansas City, it's quite literally identical on a per-target basis to Kareem Hunt and Damian Williams, a little less resembling of his, but it's basically the same. So Taylor, it's like there's nothing in his athletic traits that explains why he would be a poor pass catcher. I think it's all explained by the lack of reps. And if he's taken from a 30 carry a game sort of job at Wisconsin and put into one in the NFL where he's getting 10 or 12 carries a game behind Damian Williams, it's like he's going to have all these reps, just like these surplus reps that used to go to, you know, carries.
that he can now spend in passing down functions, and I think it's reasonable to say he will get better at those things with those reps. So Damian Williams is a great fit for the Chiefs offense, and I think he would remain the starter for however many games he was healthy to do it. But A, he's had a lot of durability troubles, and B, he's not a long-term thing. Like, they're not committed to him beyond this year. So the Chiefs don't have a lot of obvious needs. Their offensive line looks pretty good. Obviously, the Sammy Watkins thing is up to some uncertainty, but they have Mecole Hardman and Tyreek Hill and Travis Kelce at the very worst. And as much as they could maybe justify a pick here on a receiver, especially if they cut Sammy Watkins, I think it's just as likely that they find this a good opportunity to get a running back question solved for the next 5 years. And as much as people like to harp on, you know, it's inefficient to invest in running backs in the first round, I'd say it's more so inefficient to spend money on running backs. I think it actually makes a ton of sense to take a 32nd pick and just kind of run that player into the ground and not give them a second contract. I think you'll find it actually that that's maybe one of the most efficient things you can do with running backs going forward, because it's a late first round pick. It's not like you're taking this running back at the expense of taking a quarterback. And of course, in the Chiefs' case, it wouldn't even matter if they were. So I think that if Taylor goes in the first round, Kansas City makes as much sense as any place aside from Tampa Bay. But I feel like Tampa Bay would need to trade back if they were going to take Taylor.
Yeah,
in the first.
14 would be crazy for Tampa Bay. So I think that, yeah, we're gonna be waiting a while for the first running back to go off the board. Like you said, late first seems like a reasonable projection there. And yeah, I'm interested to see because, I mean, I guess like my knee-jerk reaction is that I thought that Kansas City and Andy Reid would be more inclined in a more proven pass catching running back, but I think you laid out a pretty good case that, you know, that can be developed with time when it comes to Taylor, because there are just so few reps to really point to during his time at Wisconsin. But the running talent is, like you said, very obvious. Let's move on to the second round here. Before we get to skill guys, just want to note that you have Isaiah Wilson going at the top of round two. I don't see him, or I haven't seen him going at that high recently in mocks, but like I'm on board with that. I think that he,
oh, I'm glad you are.
he is a freak. I mean, like, I remember when he committed to Georgia, and I think I was recording a podcast. I mean, this is a couple years ago now, and my phone just like blew up from everyone just flipping out that Georgia had landed this guy. I mean, he's an absolute mountain, 6'6", 350 with some movement. So I think, like, even though it never like became the true like starting left tackle at Georgia, because obviously Andrew Thomas was that guy, I think Wilson could develop into, you know, one of the best tackles in this class. This is going to go down as one of like the best offensive line classes in recent memory, and Wilson, I think, will be part of that. Let's move on to San Francisco. So obviously the trade partner with Indianapolis in this experiment here. So pick 34, they picked Deebo Samuel last year around this stage of the draft on day two, maybe double dipping here, going for a player with a very similar skill set in Laviska Shenault.
Yeah, with Deebo and Shenault, it's pretty obvious the way you use them. It's just in Shanahan's offense specifically, what he does is he uses a lot of motion and a lot of, you know, the zone runs to the outside, the threat of George Kittle, the motion to tangle up the defense generally, and then you isolate somebody against a vulnerable defender and you create an opening. And in Debo's case, it also featured a lot of jet sweeps, handoff type things. But the deal is they just create a quick opening and then they get the ball to this guy who it's kind of a manufactured touch almost. Like, he's not getting open in the way that you usually mean it when someone gets open. It's like, it's more like they create an opening and this guy ends up there. And you throw him the ball, and then he's big and good at breaking tackles, and corners are, you know, 20, 30 pounds lighter than him, and it's hard for the corners to tackle him, so he gets a lot of yardage for an opening that wasn't that, you know, for a low difficulty throw, a throw a quarterback like Garoppolo can even hit, you know, almost every time. So with Garoppolo being limited, it makes sense to keep hammering the yards after the catch threat. And the one thing I can't really figure out is just what Shanahan thinks of his current receivers, because they put a second round restricted free agent tag on Kendrick Bourne, who's the main slot guy last year, but they were going to make Trent Taylor the main slot guy coming out of training camp before he broke his foot. So I don't know if it's, and Jalen Hurd was also getting pretty high reviews before he got hurt. So I can't tell if Shanahan is sold on Taylor or and Hurd, or if he's agnostic on one or both, or if he is sold on both but just unsure of their health. And so to whatever extent he might be unsure of their health, maybe he's not concerned enough to spend a second round pick when he's already got a second round valuation on Bourne and Deebo Samuel drafted last year in the second round. Maybe they don't go receiver here, but if they do, then Chenault, I think, pretty obviously fits their offense.
Yeah, I like that call. I love the fit there. Let's move on to the next pick. We got Detroit bolstering their receiver position.
Yeah, so people are going to think that I hate Justin Jefferson or something because I projected Mims and Chenault going ahead of him. But Justin Jefferson I projected at 35 to Detroit just because Marvin Jones is in the last year of his contract. Danny Amendola is back, but he's just a slot guy. And after those two and Kenny Galladay, they don't really have anything at receiver. So there's a non-zero chance they just kind of trade or cut Marvin Jones before the season starts. And I think they therefore will – I think they're as good of a candidate as most teams to go receiver, in the first two rounds. If they do, then Jefferson makes a ton of sense because he could be their long-term slot guy after Amendola. They could be – he could be their long-term starter opposite Kenny Galladay outside. He could do both things. And it's a case where you know, as much as I have Jefferson going later than Mims and Chenault, it's entirely due to team fit that I have it reasoned that way, because with Mims, it's the downfield speed that the Eagles need so badly. With Chenault, it's just kind of the way it fits the Shanahan yards after the catch setup offense. With Detroit and with a quarterback like Stafford, it's like this is a guy who can actually throw the ball from pretty much any look and make any kind of NFL throw. And in that case, it makes more sense to have a innately skilled receiver like Jefferson, or at least like I think Jefferson is, because it's not necessarily opening up the offense that's his function. It's not necessarily yards after the catch that's his function. It's getting open and making it, presenting a viable target from a variety of looks. And I think Jefferson, the way he produced at LSU, the way he tested at the combine, I think there's a lot of reason to believe that even if he's not like a wide receiver one type, he could be another Marvin Jones type who puts up wide receiver one type numbers at times. And, you know, if he, especially if he has better durability luck, you could imagine him just kind of being, you know, the Terry Glenn to some Terrell Owens or something like that. Like a really feared receiver who doesn't end up in the top 10 rankings ever, but is just always valuable.
Yeah. That's a lot of fun names, dropping there. And again, like, when it comes to Marvin Jones, I feel like he's one of the more like unsung, like consistent fantasy contributors over, you know, the better part of the last like 6-7 years at this point. So I could definitely see Detroit going ahead and continuing to add around Stafford, you know, because, you know, they are tied to Stafford. They want to give him as many weapons as they can. Let's move on to the guy who arguably just kind of won the combine, and that's Chase Claypool landing at 36 to the Giants.
Yeah, so with the Giants, they could theoretically use some help at receiver because of Sterling Shepard and his concussion concerns, and then also at tight end because Evan Ingram and his foot issue. And there, I can't remember who was reporting it, but some substantial NFL media person, I want to say a month ago, said something about how the Giants are concerned that he'll never be healthy, Evan Ingram. So I feel like Claypool can be justified by either of both of those angles, because I think he could play a wide receiver just fine. It's not like I don't believe he needs to move to tight end. Running a 4.42 and jumping the way he did will make you feel better about a wide receiver projection. Yeah. But Evan Ingram tested very similarly coming out of Mississippi. He was a little smaller. I think he ran a 4.42, though, just the same as Claypool did. And they obviously thought of him as a tight end. They committed to that vision. They could do that with Claypool too, for all I know. Like if the Giants, not that I have any reason to think they'll do this, but if they trade Evan Ingram for like a third or a fourth round pick, then Claypool would be the most obvious plug-in replacement for that particular kind of role, the particular kind of way that they've used Ingram as a pass catching specialist. So I think Claypool makes a lot of sense for a bunch of teams. In my previous first round mock, I projected to the Packers. This change, it wasn't in response to the Funchess thing, but I would pretty much rule it out because of the Funchess signing. So with that looking less likely to me, I would figure that Claypool's most likely landing spot is something like Detroit or the Giants. And maybe I'm too high on him. Maybe I shouldn't rank him as high as I do. But I think Claypool's production is it's not great at Notre Dame, but I think it's fine. And the thing is, when you're this athletic, I really think that if you put him on if you take him from a college team where he's playing with sub NFL players, and especially at Notre Dame, it's like they didn't suffer for lack of competition. So it would have been one thing if he had been on a low level of competition team and still not stood out. But he came pretty close to standing out production wise. And with these kinds of tools, I'm willing to bet that he's just going to look better on a decent NFL team.
Yeah, I could definitely see that. I'm in on Claypool. Claypool was a guy that was interesting, you know, coming into the pre-draft process. And then the way the combine went, you know, it's like he's not slipping past pick 40, in my opinion, no matter what.
And I want to say real quick, like, I know Miles Boykin will be hoisted as an example of why we should doubt Chase Claypool. But for as much as it's a reasonable concern, Boykin's production was substantially worse because he basically did nothing at Notre Dame for 3 years and then had one pretty decent fourth year. Claypool had a better fourth year than Boykin did, and his first 3 years were substantially better. So I think he's a clearly better prospect.
Yes, good to lay that out there. Let's keep it moving here. So we got next up at pick 39, the Dolphins addressing the running back position once again.
Yeah, so they signed Jordan Howard. They still have Laird. They still have Gaskin. But I don't think those two are serious. They're not guys who you want in your projected snap count in a game. You want those guys to be healthy scratches, if at all possible, or special teamers, something like that. So Jordan Howard can take up maybe up to like 30 snaps in a game, and even that's probably pushing it a little bit. So they have a lot of snaps to still account for in the backfield, and between that and the probability that they specifically get someone who can do passing down functions, I thought Clyde Edwards-Helaire would make a lot of sense for the Dolphins at the 39th pick, but it's not something I feel strongly about. Like, it could be any of him, DeAndre Swift, or J.K. Dobbins. I think any of the three is a high probability target for the Dolphins with this specific pick. I just thought that Edwards-Helaire, I thought his combine was a really good one. I know he didn't have as fast of a 40. Like, DeAndre Swift ran the 4.48. Clyde Edwards-Helaire only had a 4.6. But the 40-inch vertical, the really strong broad jump, that's more interesting to me because I never thought of these guys as like home run hitters. Like, I wasn't looking for any of these guys to be Jamaal Charles or something. When you watch Clyde Edwards-Helaire, he kills the defense by just dicing them up underneath, staying low when contact arrives, bouncing off for a little bit here and there. It was never supposed to be a thing where he runs away from defenses. Like, it would have been concerning for Jonathan Taylor if he had a bad 40 because he is supposed to run away from defenses. Edwards-Helaire doesn't really need that. And I think that the explosiveness that he demonstrated shows that his method of running back will definitely work in the NFL. And he's been a little more durable than DeAndre Swift and even J.K. Dobbins, although he didn't take on nearly the workload that especially not Dobbins, and also smaller workload in terms of 4 years or 3 years than Swift did. But that 1 year last year, he took quite a big workload and he was just dynamite the whole time. Looks great on film. The 4.6 gets a minus mark from a lot of people, but I just don't care. I think he had a great combine and I think he's going to go in the top 50.
Okay. Love that. And, you know, he's got a really, you know, kind of complete skill set. I think he can be, you know, even though, you know, you see 5'7", 207, you don't immediately think that he can be that three down back. He can do it all, really. I'm definitely a believer of his. I tweeted out a GIF of him against Texas earlier this week that he put this guy in the spin cycle. And I don't know what that guy's doing now, but I hope he's not playing football anymore.
It looked like a good spin move, but then it also looked like the field got like tugged to the right and like the tackler went with it or something. It's like the rug got pulled out from him also in addition to a spin move. Edwards-Helaire reminds me quite a bit of Brian Westbrook, I think.
That's high praise. I love Brian Westbrook. So yeah, if he can, you know, come 90% of the way to Brian Westbrook's career, that's a hell of a career for him. All right, so let's move on. We're outside the top 40 now. Pick 41, Cleveland, what are they doing there?
So I gave them Jalen Reagor, part of that being just kind of So I projected for the Browns to trade back from that 10th pick to the 18th pick, had them taking Austin Jackson, who's an offensive tackle. I think they still need a tackle. Maybe they don't. Maybe I'm wrong. But if they take a tackle in the first round, then it's kind of like at that point, I'm not sure what left they have to target. I guess you could say linebacker with Joe Schobert gone. Christian Kirksey is also gone. But Jalen Reagor, I just am very high on, and maybe I'm too high on him. But I have trouble having him fall further than this because I still think he's really good. And the thing with Cleveland is they look like they're either going to go to kind of like a two tight end offense a lot of the time with Njoku and Hooper, or they're going to basically get rid of Njoku and go to kind of like a three wide sort of offense. But in that case, Jarvis Landry has to pretty much play the slot. And in that part of the field, he's running for the same routes that Austin Hooper is, who they just signed and paid a lot of money. I think Jarvis Landry's contract is an awful contract, and he's going to be on the shelf until August. So I wouldn't be shocked if he's cut or traded or something like that. And even if they don't do any of that, I think it would be irresponsible for them to assume he can contribute because he had a labrum tear in his hip, I think, surgically repaired, and it's August that he's out till. That's not even to, you know, get a specific return date, or B, know when he'll be up to speed from that initial return date. Like, it's possible he'll kind of just be screwed up until October or something. So I thought it made sense to go for Reagor there. I just think he's an awesome prospect. I know that he disappointed with his 40 time at the combine, but if you look at those tapes Fusuvu was posting, it looked kind of damning that they gave him that time. Like, it looked closer to 4.4 flat or a 4.43 or something.
I can't go that far. I don't know.
I mean, it looks here's the thing. He was timed slower in the 40 than Justin Jefferson, and we know he is faster than Justin Jefferson. Like, you turn on the Jalen Reagor tape at TCU, he's the kind of fast that you just don't see that much. And I know he's 11 pounds heavier at 206 than he was listed at TCU, and maybe the weight gain it lowered the speed accordingly. But if it did, I don't know why he would post the insane vertical and broad jumps.
Right, yeah, it doesn't line up with like the 99th percentile for this year's class in the jumps. Like, you know, you would expect, you know, at the very least, very low 4.4s to match up with that kind of, like, you know, burst from the lower body there.
Yeah, so the Jarvis Landry contract and also the Odell Beckham contract, I mean, there's no cap penalty if they get rid of him. I wouldn't if I was them, but I guess I can't rule out the chance that they would either, you know, anytime coming up or next year. It's like they can get rid of him at any point and not take any cap hit. So maybe after this year they trade Beckham for a first or something like that. I don't know. But between Landry and Beckham's contracts, I feel like something is a little amiss with their wide receiver situation, and I feel like Reagor is a good enough prospect to just take him for that reason alone.
Okay, I like that call. Let's move on. We got – is this the first tight end off the board here?
Yeah.
Okay, so Indianapolis going after Albert O.
Yeah, so Okwebunam, I think they try to say it as. I don't know. But he's the guy from Missouri who surprised everybody by running the 4.4940, which – he wasn't that high on my board going into it. He was more of like a third, fourth round kind of prospect in my mind going into the combine. But we know he's good in the red zone. Like, that was one thing that even his skeptics would have given him, is like, yeah, he's pretty dangerous in the jump ball in the end zone. Like, it's really tough to block out the catch radius that he presents. So now if you tell me he's running a 4.49 in addition to that, that opens up a whole bunch of ways that I can imagine using him now, specifically between the 20s, which before you might have thought, like, yeah, he's just another Bubba Franks or something. Like, he's just going to catch play action at the goal line for 8 touchdowns a year and 300 yards or something. But as much as people were surprised by his 4.49, I tend to look at things like that as it's not that he has – track speed that doesn't factor into the real play. I don't consider him a workout warrior, in other words, for the fact. I tend to chalk it up to optical illusion. Like, I think it's just it takes a lot of hubris, I think, to just look at tape and assume you know for sure how fast a guy specifically is, because people have different stride lengths. They generate their strides in different ways. They sometimes don't cut loose with their full speed for anecdotal reasons, be it like the scheme or like the route that they have on a given play or how they're supposed to pace their routes relative to the drop back. Like, we just don't know whether Okwuegbunam was really told to cut loose. And now we know when he does, he can run a 4.49, even though he's one of the biggest tight ends in the draft. So I don't know. I think that he could be another Mark Andrews kind of factor with that kind of speed and that kind of catch radius. And it's not like he ever struggled as a pass catcher at Missouri. If anything, they're just like, you look at the criticism of him in like the NFL.com profile, and it says, you know, he doesn't try to block hard enough. They think he's soft. That's exactly what they said about Mark Andrews. And he wasn't as productive as Mark Andrews, but the thing is, like, I don't know what Mark Andrews would have done in the Missouri offense. Like, he wouldn't have been playing the slot receiver position that he did at Oklahoma. He would have had to play in line, and maybe he would have looked worse for it. I don't know. But with the Colts, I just thought, you know, Jack Doyle's good. They like Mo Alie-Cox as a blocking specialist, but Okwuegbunam would be a way for them to just hurt the middle of the field in a particular way that they can't right now. And they also don't have a ton of obvious needs otherwise, or at least I don't think. It's like their offensive line set. They just got DeForest Buckner. Their defensive line is fine. And, you know, Darius Leonard at linebacker. They got a couple corners that they do their, like, they're kind of like Buffalo zone defense with. So I don't expect them to really pay up a lot in the secondary as a general rule. And it's like, I don't know, you know, if they got quarterback and Jalen Hurts, like I project before, I don't know why they wouldn't be able to justify a pick for a tight end there. And maybe it's not Okwuegbunam, maybe it's Cole Kmet from Notre Dame. I also like Dalton Keene a lot from Virginia Tech, but I can't tell if people are going to be as high on him as I am. But I think tight end would make sense, and specifically an athletic one, not specifically to replace Eric Ebron, but just because it looks like a spot where they could use the help, and they don't seem to have a lot of needs otherwise.
Okay, let's move on over. We got a couple running backs in two of the next three picks. We got Tampa Bay going after DeAndre Swift, and then at pick 47, Atlanta, despite just getting Todd Gurley, maybe dipping into the running back well and going after J.K. Dobbins.
Right, so Clyde Edwards-Helaire, DeAndre Swift, J.K. Dobbins, they're all in the same tier for me. I have no strong opinion about which should go before the others. So I had DeAndre Swift go 45th to Tampa, but he could go to that Miami pick just as easily. Clyde Edwards-Helaire could just as easily go to Tampa at the 45th, or Dobbins could go before all of them, you know, go to Miami, go to Tampa Bay, whatever. But Atlanta, their deal is Todd Gurley's only got a one-year contract. I don't know if that is part of their calculus at all. It doesn't need to be. You don't need to take a running back just because Todd Gurley's on a one-year deal, but it would be a way to rationalize taking one. And J.K. Dobbins is good enough to do it. You know, it's like, it's not as if they're reaching or something. They're getting at worst a going rate for a really good prospect. So it makes sense for Atlanta to go running back. I think, I guess they might prefer Swift for the Georgia thing.
That'd be tight.
Those three guys go in that general range. I think I projected Devin DuVernay, the receiver from Texas, to go to Denver at 46, and I'm apparently way higher on DuVernay than most people. I can't really figure out why. It's one of those things where there's a consensus for some reason, but no one will answer the question of how they got there. And I don't know. I mean, usually there's some sort of reason, and oftentimes these are kind of plugged in people who are just kind of repeating what they're hearing from within the league, and the league's opinion matters a lot more than mine. But with Devin DuVernay, what we have here is a guy who breaks a lot of tackles, is densely built, and is one of the fastest receivers in the class, who had one of the best seasons last year among the receivers in the class. So he in the slot for Denver specifically would make a lot of sense, I think, because they had Deshaun Hamilton
terrible,
just tanking the offense. He was playing a lot of snaps last year for a guy who did nothing at all. And he's not fast. He's not big. Devin DuVernay is much more densely built than Hamilton, and he's so much faster. Very dangerous with the football. I think adding that kind of speed in the middle of the field would help neutralize the safeties. They would slow the washing of the safeties toward Cortland Sutton's direction a little bit. Like, if you put Devin DuVernay and Cortland Sutton on the same side of the field in a three receiver set, it's one of those things, like, the safety's probably going to lean towards Sutton, but if he does, and if you put DuVernay on a fly route, they might not do it again. And that could just open things up that much more for Sutton. And I really think DuVernay will be good for his own part. Like, I don't think he's going to be a decoy. I think he's going to be a really good receiver. So if I was Denver, I'd be interested.
Yeah, I think Denver definitely needs to add a receiver. I think they've had, you know, I think the Hamilton experiment isn't really going to work out over time. Tim Patrick should be no more than your wide receiver 4 or 5, that type of thing. And you know, with this year's class in the depth therein at receiver, I think that they would be very wise to address that position. And I think the way that you position Duvernay there, like you said, would make a lot of sense. But I think they can go in a couple different directions. So we'll see what ends up happening there. They'll certainly have options. Let's move on then. I know that you had Cole Kmet there going pick 49 to Pittsburgh. I think Pittsburgh, they definitely need to get their tight end situation figured out a little bit more. They've been struggling in that, despite trying a litany of guys over the last couple of years here. But I mean, I don't know how deep of a dive you want to get into Kmet here before we keep moving on.
He's a Kyle Rudolph kind of prospect.
Yeah. You know? I like him. I think he has a good game, but nothing to get crazy about. And I don't know how big of a fantasy producer he'll be year one. So now we have a couple of big receivers going towards the later part of the second round, guys that I'm really high on. So I'm interested to see or hear your takes on them and this the way that you fit them in into your mock. Let's talk about T. Higgins going to Baltimore at 55 and Michael Pittman at 58 to Minnesota.
So I am really unsure of what to make of T. Higgins at this point because the production and the film are pretty stellar. The workout from his pro day is kind of concerning, but I also can't even tell if the reporting is reliable.
Right.
Because when it was initially reported that he ran his 40, they were saying he was timed at a 4.43, and then the official time for some reason is being listed as 4.59. And on the one hand, it's like the 4.43 might be what more teams believed he ran for all I know, but I don't know. And if anybody believes that he ran a 4.59, then it's all of a sudden kind of hard to really fall in love with him in a receiver class as strong as this. Like if it was weaker receiver class, then I'd probably say the 35th pick, something like that. But when you have these other guys who don't have an athleticism question and also have really strong production, it's tough for me to lean toward Higgins on just the basis of faith and, you know, reputation. But
I mean, Chenault at a 4.58.
Yeah, he also was at the combine and he was also quite a bit more densely built. And he was like running through a sports hernia or something like that.
Okay.
He had to get something surgically repaired. I can't remember what it was. But and the other thing is, like in that case, it's like Chenault really fits, I think, the San Francisco offense, whereas I don't know if T. Higgins would. But right. He would if he's any good, he'll definitely fit what Baltimore needs, which is basically like a good Miles Boykin.
Yeah, what Miles Boykin's supposed to be.
Yeah. So I think you can be skeptical of Higgins and also think that he would work well in Baltimore because we've seen the way he can kind of bully downfield, and we know he's not going to be double teamed or anything with Mark Andrews and Marquise Brown on the field. So we don't need this third receiver in the Baltimore offense to even be especially good. This should be kind of a layup for any decent receiver prospect. And even if you're skeptical of Higgins, I think you can consider him a sufficient candidate for that.
Yeah, I would really as a Ravens guy, that would be an excellent pick. I'd be very interested in that, but we'll see what happens. But I'm a Higgins believer. I do think he has everything that you need. I love the tools in terms of like the size, the hands, the years of production. I love Clemson receivers just in general. They seem to tend to work out pretty well at the next level. Baltimore pretty terrible at picking receivers in general, but it looks like Hollywood Brown's going to work out, and I imagine that they will address the position before day two is over. And if it ends up being Higgins in round two, then I think that would be a strong pick for them. Moving on to Minnesota, obviously, they have a very thin receiving core now that they have jettisoned Stephon Diggs. And in this mock, you did not have them addressing receiver in the first round. But you figure that before round two is over, they need to go ahead and do that. And Michael Pittman, certainly a completely different receiver than Stephon Diggs, but a huge target with pretty nice athleticism to boot.
Yeah, Pittman is the kind of receiver that Minnesota could really use. And as much as, you know, you wouldn't want to demote or push aside a player like Diggs just for the sake of, adding balance to an offense, it is more balanced to have the bigger receiver opposite Adam Thielen than a second receiver who's like Adam Thielen. Like Diggs and Thielen are both kind of really good route runners who get open a lot, but they're not going to bully anyone for the ball. They're not an obvious red zone target. And Pittman or Higgins are the kind of receiver that would give that sort of balanced look to the base formation for the Vikings. And they're really good on their own part, obviously, too. It's not just like, desperately looking for a type of receiver that leads us here. It's that Pittman shouldn't really go further than this in the draft order. I think you could make a case for him in the late first round. You could make a case for him for the Eagles at the 21st pick. So I kind of felt anxious even having him fall this far. And I actually have him ranked ahead of T. Higgins in the dynasty rankings. So I don't know how I reconcile that exactly, but I just assume Higgins's brand is a little stronger for some reason. I could be wrong, though, because Higgins had a bad or at least like ambiguous pro day, and Pittman had a really solid combine. Like he posted very similar numbers to what Kenny Galladay did. And then you look at his production at USC, it's really good. So I just don't really see any grounds for doubting him at this point. And if he goes earlier than 58, it would not surprise me.
Nice. I've been happy to see your like the progression of your thought process on Pittman from dating back to January up to now. So I'm glad that I'm not crazy for having believed in him.
No, not at all.
All right, so stamp it. Pittman going on day two. We got one more guy to get to before we get into a little bit of the free agent odds and ends before we round things out here. So Green Bay, you have to imagine, you know, it was a repeated problem. It's been a repeated problem for them that outside of Devontae Adams, it's been brutal as far as what Aaron Rodgers has to throw to up in Green Bay. So you figure that addressing receiver, I mean, they keep doing it. It just doesn't seem to work out. But you figure maybe they'll keep giving it a try here and go after a receiver here in round two.
Yeah, so I gave Green Bay at the 62nd pick Brandon Ayuk from Arizona State. And Ayuk's kind of in a similar territory to me as Denzel Mims, where some guys I look at and I just know what I think, and I don't know what I think about Ayuk. I see cases for concern or for optimism, and he was a good player at Arizona State. His production was similarly good relative to the team's baseline as what N'Keal Harry's was. So it's not like he's obviously worse of a player at a glance. He's more athletic. Like he's not the same kind, or he's not as big as Harry. He's more fast and quick than him. So it's not the same kind of player. But yeah, for whatever it's worth, I'm not marginalizing Ayuk because of Harry. I'm not doing the thing where like this guy was bad, so now I'm concerned they all are. I just didn't see anything on tape as far as like obvious standout route running ability. I feel like if you turn on tape of Brandon Ayuk and then watch tape of Jerry Jeudy and Bryan Edwards, you'll immediately think like, oh yeah, Ayuk isn't as good of a route runner as those two. Like those two have a way of just an innate spatial intelligence that allows them to just twist the person in front of them around without even like running faster than them, without being bigger than them, whatever. It's like they just kind of have a way of, you know, using head fakes, body language, the way they lean when they're running certain ways, where they probably keep their eyes as they're running, things like that. It all fits in, and it amounts to these really small details about like, you know, Bryan Edwards is going against Alabama, but he keeps getting open underneath. And then you watch Ayuk and it's like he's so much faster than a guy like Edwards or Tyler Johnson or something like that. But he doesn't seem to just get open as much. But Ayuk is fast. And it's like you get a guy like him in an offense and, you know, it's like a busted coverage happens. He's going to be a problem. Like if your zones aren't disciplined and Ayuk's running against you, he can be a problem for you. It's more against the man coverage that I'm not as sold. But Daniel Jeremiah has been pushing Ayuk as like a top 40 kind of pick, like a frequently projected first rounder. So someone like him, someone like Jeremiah is plugged in. Whatever I think about Ayuk does not matter as much as what someone like Jeremiah thinks. So if he's projecting him that high, I have to assume he's going to go pretty high. And so I largely projected Ayuk here just because I felt like it would be irresponsible to project him to fall out of the second round just because I don't really like him that much. But yeah, I haven't projected to go to Green Bay here. And the Devin Funchess signing wouldn't change the calculus very much. I think they signed Funchess largely to do some of the things that they had in mind for Austin Hooper, who they were linked to in free agency. And Devin Funchess played tight end at Michigan, and Hooper plays a lot in the slot as a receiver. So I think Funchess could do some of that stuff. therefore they still have a need outside. Like, I don't think Funchess is just all they were looking for outside, and Ayuk would make sense if Green Bay is inclined.
Yeah, looking back at my notes on Ayuk, watched a few of his games a month or so ago, I obviously knew who he was during the season, obviously, because he was a huge college fantasy producer. But, noticed that he lined up, in a variety of spots. It felt like he could run most of the routes in the route tree. Just good, spatial awareness, like you said. And that also bears out in his punt return production as well. I mean, he was a guy that averaged 16 yards on his punt returns and
yeah.
even had a punt run back for a touchdown. So, I mean, he's got that ability once he has the ball in his hands to make stuff happen.
Sorry if I can interrupt. Sorry. I would say Ayuk is someone I would feel more confident in if he was in the San Francisco offense, because like you said, once he has the ball, it's not hard to imagine what he can do. And that offense is really good at kind of manufacturing that sort of touches. I'm worried about him if he is in an offense where you're expected to beat press man coverage consistently.
Okay. That's definitely a fair critique of his, because he's not the biggest guy in the world. Probably wasn't even asked to do that all that often at Arizona State. So did you have any thoughts to expound upon when it came to that Funchess signing for Green Bay?
I like it. I think it's a low risk thing. The wide receiver market in free agency was pretty cold, and yet Funchess is a guy who was a top prospect 5 years ago. He was always more toolsy than skilled, and so he was still productive at a young age at Michigan is the thing. And when that happens, there are some exceptions to this rule, but generally when that happens, I think that's the kind of player who will eventually be good, or at least have good fantasy seasons, even if they are annoying in their trajectory the whole way. Dante Moncrief is one exception to this. He was really good as a freshman at Mississippi, very toolsy, started out reasonably well in the NFL, but just never got better. Funchess could be the exact same thing, but until the final nail is in the coffin, I think he still has a chance to be pretty good. And I think, if it doesn't cost much to find out, then it makes sense to take that plunge. And again, if Green Bay was truly in on Hooper, as it was initially reported, then that means they imagined Hooper playing a lot of slot snaps. And so if you want a big guy doing slot snaps like that with tight end sort of background, Funchess does make sense for that.
Hey, and I mean, if you're talking about teams chasing big names, I mean, the Falcons have aren't all 11 of their starting offensive personnel former first rounders?
Oh, geez, I don't know.
I think that actually might be the case. So, being facetious there for a second.
Oh, but, yeah, no, yeah, Hayden Hurst is there.
But, I mean, to the larger point, when a guy does carry that first-round tag and Funchess is young relative to his experience in the NFL, maybe Green Bay will be the place where it gets unlocked. We'll see. And, again, if you're Green Bay, it's not like you're piling on a huge amount of assets to have him on the roster there. So
it's low risk. They're not committed to him, and if he's bad, it won't matter.
Yep. Let's move on to we talked about Breshad Perriman to the Jets earlier. His move, kind of replaces the Robbie Anderson role, at least in theory, for the Jets. And Robbie Anderson goes to Carolina. And I tweeted right when I saw this that I can't think of a more oil and water type of fit when it comes to what Anderson brings to the table versus Bridgewater. I like both players, but I don't see their skills meshing very well.
Yeah, I think with Carolina and their choice to sign Anderson, it was kind of just they looked at it as it might be similar to thinking of when you're in an auction draft for fantasy sports and you've got $40 left and you only have one spot left on your roster. And the guy who's up on the board, he's only worth 11, but why do you care? You have $40 left and you can't take it with you. So it's I think it's not quite that, because I think Anderson is totally worth that contract. I think it was easy to justify spending that money when it was just auction money they were going to take, into the reserve round or whatever and never put it to use otherwise. So Curtis Samuel is a free agent. If he walks after this year, or if someone gives them an offer – That's compelling. It's like now they can trade Curtis Samuel or let him walk, and they don't have to answer the question about, well, who's going to be the fast receiver next year then, or rather the downfield receiver. DJ Moore is fast. He just doesn't have a natural downfield skill set, whereas Samuel and Anderson both do. But beyond that, I think it's a totally good signing because it was just an unreasonably cold market for Anderson. Like, I feel like there's other free agent classes where he would have gotten like 13 or 14 million over 4 years per year over 4 years. And here in this particular market, he was only able to get 20 million over 2 years, 10 million per year. So if you can get a guy below where you can reasonably imagine him costing in another context, it makes sense to lock in that kind of like interest rate, you know, when it's lower like that. And otherwise beyond that though, having Anderson on the field, even if he's not getting targets, let alone catches, and even if he's not having his downfield abilities maximized by the quarterback, the safeties still have to respect him and the threat that he poses. And in a three receiver base, if you have, and in my opinion, what they should do is have DJ Moore in the slot rather than Curtis Samuel. Last year, they had Samuel play in the slot more than DJ Moore. I thought that was backwards. I would want Samuel and Anderson outside and the speed that they have being the main focus of the safeties so that DJ Moore always is on single coverage against a nickel defensive back. And in that case, their offense could just kind of have a nice, a credible threat, basically, from in all parts of the field, which makes it hard for a defense to key on any one particular part. So, yeah, if his only utility is making the safety on his half of the field, you know, backpedal a few more seconds and create that much more space for DJ Moore and Christian McCaffrey, then it'll be useful.
Okay. And, you know, I think there is also the Matt Rhule connection.
Yeah, and I wonder what that I know that people, and I imagine Anderson's price was as low as it was, by the way, because of people doubting his character, because there was a thing with that cop. Like, people are like, oh, he's a bad guy. He was mouthing off to a cop, and you know, he's a bad guy. He got kicked out of Temple because he had bad grades. Well, the coach who was with him when he got kicked off the team apparently didn't want him to go. Yeah. So what does that tell you about, you know, what his character is? If the guy who knows him as well as anybody says like, oh, I'll take him then.
Yeah, exactly. So I think that there's something there. And also, we'll see what Joe Brady made Joe Burrow into the greatest college quarterback for a season ever. So maybe Joe Brady can elevate this offense overall greater than the sum of its parts. So we'll have to see how that all works out. But I'm interested at the very least. I wish that Anderson would have, or more simply, just gone somewhere where I know that the quarterback throws it downfield. But, you know, crazier things have happened here. Let's move on over to Emmanuel Sanders going to the Saints.
Yeah, I like Emmanuel Sanders enough, and he's definitely good at some things, but I don't know if I'm as high on this signing as most people are, because I'm worried that unlike the Anderson case with Carolina, I think that Sanders could be a guy who's not in a position to have his skills maximized by the quarterback in question and the structure of the offense generally, but he won't offer the decoy value that Anderson will. Like, it's not even like a decoy thing with Anderson. It's like he is a credible downfield threat. If the safety ignores him, the worst quarterback in the league can chuck the ball that way and probably get it there. Okay. It's like single coverage when the corner's trailing behind him. Any quarterback can make that throw, generally speaking. It's harder to make the throws when the coverage is ambiguous and when you have to like anticipate the guy getting open. If you have to throw the guy open, it's a little more complicated. And I think with the Saints, you've got an offense where the quarterback largely has the same limitations as Bridgewater. Like, I don't think it's just the structure of the Saints offense that leads to low depth of target for Drew Brees. And so even though Sanders is good at certain stuff, I'm worried that he's a bit redundant there, because Michael Thomas is never going to be a downfield receiver. Their main deep threat right now is Jared Cook. And that's generally bad, I think, because if the safeties creep up on that offense, and, you know, not that they're going to stop Michael Thomas, that's not a concern. But the whole thing is, if this Sanders signing is supposed to be useful, it's going to be useful because they added a dimension that wasn't there before, a threat that didn't exist previously. And I don't know if they did that, because even though Sanders can get open underneath, it doesn't matter because Thomas is going to be open before him. Yep. And I just don't see the obvious way Sanders adds something truly new. I thought they, especially if they're going to take Ted Ginn off the field, then you're going to want to assume the safeties are going to creep up in response. And if they do, you should have a plan for a way to make them hurt for it. And I don't know what – I mean, it is – particularly at his current age, it's not like Emmanuel Sanders is going to take a slant, you know, split the safeties, go the distance. So I don't see the way they're going to get big plays. And maybe they just move the chains endlessly, but you have Kamara running in that part of the field too. So I don't know. It seems like a bit of a redundancy concern, in my opinion, even though I think Sanders is a good player generally.
Interesting. Yeah, that they're really, you know, you look at that depth chart and there really isn't like that downfield threat. And, you know, I think you put it really well when you said that their tight end is currently the best deep threat on that roster, and it doesn't look like they have a second round pick right now. So if they don't go after a speedy receiver in the first, which, you know, don't necessarily rule out, but, you know, we'll see what happens there. You know, they go into this year with a passing game that like is almost capped at like 15 yards down the field.
Right. And it could work. Like maybe they just, you know, get a bunch of little cuts into the defense, bleed them out that way. But I feel like they're inviting a very congested field for themselves. And it doesn't really matter how good your players are. If they're not able to utilize the whole field, it's just kind of like playing with, you know, it's fighting with one hand behind your back.
Exactly. And then any other free agent signings that caught your eye over the course of this last week?
Not really. I know Eric Ebron signed with the Steelers. Some people are excited about that. I guess he could make sense as like a 12th round pick kind of thing. It looks like Vance McDonald's on the way out. I don't think Ebron's very good, though. And, you know, I projected them to take Cole Kmet, so I obviously am not that excited by it.
Sure. Exactly. And then before we wrap things up, what is something that you've done on quarantine that you like? You're in the middle of doing it and you're like, wow, I've really just been inside for a very long time.
Oh, let me think. I don't know. I mean, I've started downloading that Call of Duty Warzone that's free. I don't even know what it is. It looks like they made Call of Duty look like Fortnite now.
Oh, no.
And I am too old for Fortnite, so I don't.
Yeah, you can't even do the dance, man.
Yeah, I don't know what any of that is. I don't want to know. But I was like, well, I don't know. I guess it's free. All the cool kids are doing it. I guess I'll give it a try. I haven't played Call of Duty since they had like Black Ops 2 or something like that. I can't play these new, really fast shooters. Like every shooting game now looks to me the way Unreal Tournament looked 20 years ago, which is to say like too fast for me to understand. And it's like there's all these people now who are just insane supercomputer humans at just playing Call of Duty and things like that, and it just ruins the game for me. But I like my slow old person shooters of the days of yore, where I could, you know, walk around at a nice pace and take in the scenery a little.
I think Black Ops 2 definitely got in the way of some grades at least one of my semesters in college. But I love that game. But yeah, I think if you threw me in on the new COD, on the new consoles, I would be, you know, fresh meat for everybody. I don't have a console right now, kind of on purpose. And I'm regretting it right now because I'm pretty bored. And to that end, I literally found myself last week at one point, I performed maintenance on my vacuum.
Oh, congratulations, dude.
I know, right? So
and you have a vacuum.
I do have a vacuum. I mean, I have carpet in my apartment, so kind of necessary. But
I do too. I still don't have one.
Well, if you ever need, you know, a contactless vacuum trade, just let me know.
I can lend you my PlayStation 4 when I need to vacuum next.
I love this trade-off. This is great. Okay. All right. We got that set up then. All right. So, Mario, great stuff. As always, really appreciate you taking the time. That's going to wrap things up for this week's RotoWire NFL podcast. Check back next week. We'll be back on. So have a good week, everybody.